Sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvi navadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
Oh, can you again please talk about when to use the words Ishwara and Bhagavan? You know, I don't know that there's some hard and fast rule, because I can speak of Ishwara as I would speak of Bhagavan. You know, I say, well, let's see what Ishwara does. I say that sometimes, let's see what Bhagavan does. So the thing is, in Sanskrit, you can have many, many words for the same, speaking about the same thing. So there's many different words for Bhagavan, and all of them have a meaning, internal meaning, going to the root and the affix, that's the prefix that's being used. So with Bhagavad, it's the one who has the six bhagas, the six Aishwarya and what are they?
Shri.
Shri Aishwarya, Tejas, Viryam, Yashas, Vairagya. So the one who has in full measure these six strengths or these six wealths. But then Aishwarya comes from Ish, the Ishdhatu, which means the one who has overlordship over everything. But there are so many other words for Ishwara. The only thing that I've ever said to differentiate, which I don't think is necessarily a valid differentiation, but we usually use Bhagavan as such kind of an affectionate, almost like a proper name, where Ishwara can be a little bit more formal, like the Lord, where Bhagavan is, you're talking about your, like your Ishtadevata almost. But that could just be personal, because I can talk that same way using Ishwara, you know, or any of the other 1,001 names we have for Bhagavan, you know, for Vishnu. And, of course, 1,001 for Shiva. So, and there are a lot of names, so all of those names are giving one aspect, or it can be unfolded. In fact, any of the 1,001 names of Vishnu, you can take any one name and just unfold it into a beautiful aspect of Ishwara. In fact, Swamiji said, of the two books that he's written, it's the Vishnu Sahasranama and the Gita Home Study, that he feels that he has everything he has to say are in those two books, you know. So those are the 1,001 names of Bhagavan, the 1,001 names of Ishwara, and each name holds in it a meaning, you know. So it's very beautiful. So I don't have I feel like the way I answer it, somebody else might answer it differently, you know. But so I'm not that anything I said was wrong. There's nothing wrong in it. It's just that there's probably a lot of personal feeling involved. And Shraddha, you know. Is moksha forever, even when the creation remanifests? What happens to the jivas in the transition of the creation from manifest to unmanifest and back to manifest? That's a nice question. They're all nice, but... okay, so first thing is that yourself has never changed through the cycles and the cycles, you know, the pralaya, I mean the total manifestation of the creation coming into manifestation, so that srishti is coming into manifestation, stiti, it's remaining, laya or pralaya, it goes into unmanifest condition. That's the cycle of the creation. It happens from beginningless time. But Brahman, yourself, is never going through manifestation or unmanifestation. So the cycles, the beginningless cycles of the creation have no effect on yourself at all. In fact, from the standpoint of yourself, there really is only you, because there is nothing all of the edges in terms of all of the nama rupas are just filled with you. So the edge is mitya, right? It has no being apart from the substance. So from your standpoint, there's only you. From the standpoint of the creation, it's all of this stuff happening. From the standpoint of the jiva, so much is happening. But if you get rid of the body, mind, sense organs for Ishwara, for Brahman, I just simply am. You know. So for Brahman, there is no creation, there is no manifestation and dissolution. Now on the part of it for the jiva, what the Shastra says is that when that self-ignorance is removed, and therefore the delusion also is removed, you are jivan muktaha, living liberated. You are liberated now. The only thing is that this body, mind, sense organs is living out its prarabdha karma, which belongs to Ishwara. This body, mind, sense organs is not subjective. It's once this birth has taken place, it is part of Ishwara's, it's a part of Ishwara's total upadhi. And so it will not go out of existence or go back into the elements until that prarabdha is finished. So say in the middle of your prarabdha, you gain knowledge, self-knowledge. So for you, this body, mind, sense organs is Ishwara, and I am Brahman. Right? And that's just the reality of, that's the truth of the whole thing. I don't have to not have this body for this body, mind, sense organs, for me to know that this body, mind, sense organs is Ishwara. You know, that's why the jiva, the jnani doesn't have an ahankara. You know, doesn't have doesn't have any attachment to anything, because I already am everything, and the ananda that I'm looking for is my own being. So they say that when the prarabdha of the jiva runs out and the body is dropped, there is no more transmigration, because there's nobody to transmigrate. There's no ajnanam there. The ajnanam that causes the kind of false identification, the projection, you know, the false identification with the upadhi, that identification is not there anymore. And so when this dies, it dies, and you're just left as who you actually are, which is Ishwara. You know, you can say, no, who I actually am is Brahman. Yes, who you actually are is Brahman. But Brahman has this maya as its incidental attribute, and from beginningless time, this maya projects, sustains and resolves, projects, sustains and resolves from beginningless time. But that, there's no possibility, because that's the incidental attribute. Incidental attribute means it doesn't bring about any change whatsoever to Brahman, to the self, just like your imagination doesn't. That's what we mean by incidental attribute. But there's no place for maya to be other than Brahman. Brahman is the adhishtana. When you say the word mitya, it means it depends 100% on something else. So what this creation depends upon to make it mitya is only me. Without me, there is no creation. You know, and so I am the self of this creation, and I am the one who has maya as its incidental attribute. And so when this physical body goes back into the elements, subtle and physical elements, I am left as Brahman, which has maya as an incidental attribute. Therefore, I am Ishwara. You know, if you think you're just, you alone are, Brahman is non-dual, okay? Non-dual. So you can't lose your body and mind as a jivanmukta, as a jnani, and go into just some little part of Brahman that doesn't get to be Ishwara. There is no part of Brahman. There is only Brahman. And Brahman has maya as its incidental attribute. See what I mean? So I'm Ishwara. That's because I am accounting for maya as an incidental attribute for Brahman. And there is no Brahman that doesn't have maya as its incidental attribute. See what I mean? But from the standpoint of Brahman, there's no maya or anything. Because I'm not a knower. I'm just the one because of whom the whole creation is known. And the whole creation is an expression of myself. So for me as a jnani, there's no reincarnation. That is over with. For an ajnani, say between the Srishti Stiti Laya, when the world goes into unmanifest condition, all of the jivas go into unmanifest condition also. And then when the world comes out, according to the karmas, the prarabdha karmas, the sanchitta. Wow. Okay. What is that called? Sanchitta karmas. Okay. Those sanchitta karmas, according to your sanchitta karmas, what you were at the time of your last incarnation and all of that, you will be born again when the time is right, just like now. But when the world is in unmanifest condition, that's just like a deep sleep state. So, and until it comes back up, you're in unmanifest condition. Brahman is always awake, but awake only to itself. So it's awake to the whole creation only from the standpoint of the creation. The sattva that reflects it. Does that make sense?
From the standpoint that there is no time, how can we stop reincarnating if there is no time? So we always stop till we always reincarnate. That's how I hear.
Well, first of all, let's just do the first thing. For Brahman, there's no time. Time belongs to the manifest creation. When the creation is in unmanifest condition, there's nothing, there's no movement. So when it's unmanifest, there's no marking of time. You know, so you can say if you go into a deep sleep and you come awake again, there was no passage of time. Say if you go for anesthesia, wow, that's really an interesting one. You know, you go into that, and you're getting surgery, you go into the anesthetic, they start counting you down, 199, 98, 97, and then you open your eyes and the surgery's over. Yeah. But you hit, say, 97, you open your eyes, the surgery's over. That's an amazing, it's an amazing experience. But from the standpoint of what is unmanifest and the mind is unmanifest, there is no passage of time at all. Time requires change, so it requires the manifest creation. You know, so now, when the creation goes into unmanifest condition, it's similar to, say, when you go into deep sleep, still, everything about your waking state, your mind, your sense organs, your memories, you know, all the experiences you have, they're in unmanifest condition, but when the mind is up, all of those things are still there. So they just went into unmanifest, then they become manifest. So there's no loss of the jiva. As long as that ajnanam is there, when you're like, just like when you're in deep sleep, you wake up to the same, you know, it's the same ignorant me. And when the creation goes into unmanifest condition and comes out, then all of those laws are applying again, and you're kind of back in the stream of things according to your karma. Did I miss something there, the question?
Yeah, I was wondering if there's no time, everything is happening at the same time. So all my different lives from the reincarnation are happening at the same time.
Why are you saying that? Because from whose standpoint is that?
From the standpoint of timelessness.
No, oh, okay. The self is not, from the standpoint of the self, let's just use, say, your imagination or dream for now, just to make it clear. When I have a dream, the dream projects, then within that dream, there's time, right? The space and time belong to the dream. Not to me, never to me. So I'm timeless, the creation is not timeless. The creation is beginningless. There's a difference. It means sequentially it comes into manifestation, goes as sthiti, and then goes out and gets in and out like that. One creation after another, after another, after another. It's not that all of the creations are happening at the same time. They're happening sequentially. That's why we say beginningless instead of timeless. Whereas for me, I'm not beginningless or endless. I am totally free from time, so I'm ever present. Like this moment right now, what your own being has never been any different. There's no time for it. But the creation is a continuation of manifestation and going into causal or unmanifest condition. Now, you can say, which is interesting, just scientifically, when we're in a given creation, because of the vastness the vastness of the creation. Einstein talked quite a bit about this. I don't want to try to be a scientist, but I think you all know what I'm saying, is that like say a star is a million light years away, you know? And so we're experiencing the star now, but it died, you know, 800,000 years ago. But that light is just reaching us now, that type of thing. And so because of the huge distances that are involved from one dimension of the creation, you haven't even been born yet. Because the light of this moment hasn't reached there yet. And so that all becomes very confusing. So Bhagavan has his own way of handling that. But if we're just looking at the cyclical nature of creation, then that is not in conflict with me, who am timeless. And another thing that might be tripping you up there, consciousness, the self, is not a knower. So I'm not witnessing or experiencing this infinite creation from the standpoint of Brahman. I simply am the one because of whom it is all known. Remember when we've kind of done those unfoldments of it is known, it is known, it is known. If you get rid of the whole creation, what is left is just the is-knownness, the self-evident nature of me. But I'm not knowing anything. But I'm the light because of which everything is known. You know? So from its own standpoint, it is known. But not from my standpoint. I'm just the knownness which is superimposed upon it. Does that help? Think about it and then we can find the way, whatever it is in there. Yeah. Can you explain again the difference between a jnani and a mumukshu? Yeah. Jnani comes from the root jna. J-N with a little wiggle on the top. Long A, jna. It means to know. Okay, so jnani is one who has knowledge. Jnana. So jna is the root. Jnana is knowledge. Jnanin, that in, it's one who has knowledge. So jnani is in the nominative singular of a declension. Jnani means the one who has knowledge. The mumukshu comes from the root much, means to release or to be free. Also means like to faint, right? In this case, it means to be released or to be free. There's a desiderative, so that's the verb much. There's a desiderative form that has the meaning of to want to be free, to desire to be free, and that desiderative involves reduplicating the root. So in this case, it would be instead of much, it would be mumuch. And then to that mumuch, you add this affect shu, and shu, su, and because of the cha, which changes to ka, that changes the sha, you get mumukshu. Okay, something like that. So it's pretty close. Okay. So anyway, what that means when you say mumukshu, the one who desires liberation. The one who desires to be free. Now, jnani, that in affects, means the one who has knowledge, so already is free, right? The one who has knowledge. Now, what if you say jignyasu? So you have mumukshu, the one who desires liberation, jignyasu, the one who desires knowledge. So the mumukshu, who desires liberation, actually becomes a jignyasu, the one who desires knowledge, because you realize that something which is inherently limited can't become free. So there's nothing you can do, so it's something you have to know. That's another whole thing I can teach you. But just to get to the roots, so the jnana in affects shows possession of that. The one who has jnana, from jna to know, the one who has knowledge. Mumukshu is a desiderative root, the one who desires liberation. That person becomes a jignyasu, the one who desires knowledge. The root jna and jna are the same. So jignyasu, the one who desires knowledge. Jnanin, the one who has knowledge. That's the difference.
Can I ask?
Sure, yeah.
So the jnani is the one that's already free.
Yeah.
And the mumukshu is the one that desires liberation.
To be free. And then the one who gains, does the shravana, the upayanishta, shravana, manana, niridhyasana, in order to gain this knowledge. And then for the antakarana shuddhi, that upayanishta, the one who's doing this primarily, this karma yoga buddhi. That's the primary means for antakarana shuddhi. Because it's not just a, what do you call it, palliative, you know, where you take a drug or something just to get rid of the pain temporarily, or take an aspirin. It's not an aspirin, because the aspirin wears off and your headache comes back. You know, it's a means of knowledge. So, and then the karma yoga is the means for gaining the mind, and that the instrument that needs to gain that knowledge, to gain that samatva buddhi. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay, good. We pray for things we believe, understand, that God is the one who truly knows what is best for us, and that we do not really know what is best for us. Can our free will, Jiva Srishti, mess up our prarabdha karma, or only creates learning opportunities on non-important events? Okay. Because most of us have probably been, the majority of people in the West have been raised as either Jewish or Christian. And probably, maybe few have been either, you know, or atheists, or they had parents that were taking on a religion, Mormon, or something that falls outside of the scope of these two. Even though with Christianity, there's like 100 different sects of Christianity, and there's many, many different types of Judaism. But all of them seem to have a God in heaven looking down, deciding what is best for us, right? And so when we're talking about Ishvara, because we've been conditioned, it's off easy, even if we don't think we're doing it. Not that you're doing it in this note, but I'm just talking about this because I talk about it at school all the time. I think it's important. We superimpose Ishvara onto that Christian God image of a God in heaven who's looking down, deciding, oh, look, she's doing this. That's not good. She should do this. Let's bump her over this way, you know. That's an anthropomorphizing, you know, God. Whereas when we look at Ishvara, it is an infinite manifestation of an infinite order. And it's an order in terms of a physical order, a psychological order, a subtle order in the terms of Hiranyagarbha, you know, scientific order, mathematical order. It's one of infinite order that includes dharma, that includes karma from a Hindu perspective. All of these things are part of that order. It includes prayer also. It includes curses. All of these things take place within this order. And the order, to kind of understand the order, you have to go to start thinking about a living being. I am a living being. You are a living being. Animals are living beings. Plants are living beings. From our experience of living beings, the living being does its best to keep the whole going as long as possible, even though there can be toxins and so many things through our free will. We really make big mistakes, actually, just in terms of our diet, the type of foods and things that we ingest, the ways that we don't take care of our body properly. And so we're doing a lot of things to sabotage our well-being. But in spite of all of that, that infinite order is continually trying to make the best of it. So you can go on surviving, so that you can go on living. So you look at that in terms of your own body, and then just kind of, and the bodies of others and of animals and of all living beings. You see that the order, the internal order, protects them and is doing its best. Not that it's not going to die, but it will put up a good fight. It'll try to keep you going for as long as it possibly can and try to protect the whole. And the creation, you can look at the creation is like that too. You can look at the earth as that. You can look at the oceans and the sea. Even though they are seeming to lose, we don't know that nature will ever lose. We might drive it to such an extent that we all have to die, you know. But then nature, the earth, can take, you know, millions of years to recover, you know. So all I'm saying is it's not that Bhagawan is looking down, you know. You are Bhagawan. Your being, it's not that the creation is not known. It's known, just like your mind is known, you know. But it is the laws that are handling all of the karma and the karmapala. And you have some control over those laws. The Vedas kind of explained all of those things to you, so you kind of know, you know, what, how to live in this world and get the maximum amount of happiness from this world if I'm a samsari. So it's really boils down to dharma. Dharma is what protects you. And then you realize that even if dharma protects me and I have that relative happiness, it's still relative, you know. Is there any way for me to be even free of dharma and a dharma to be free of, you know, raga, dvesha, all of these things? Is there anything free that's whole and complete? And then the Vedas kind of bumps you over to the second part of the Vedas, which is the Vedanta, and then that deals with the whole reality of the creation. So within the creation, within Bhagawan, there's all possibilities are there. There's prayer, which is a karma. So you're also, as a jiva, you're influencing or mitigating your karmas too, you know? And they even have that in the Vedas. Like, say you've killed a brahmana, like in this Hari Rama Upanishad, which I didn't read. There's a couple of paragraphs I didn't get to do, but not just a few lines, but I told you about it. If you kill a brahmana, which is the greatest sin that you could possibly do. I forget what the Sanskrit says, something like, I figured out 30 million times if you chant Hari Rama, that will neutralize that sin. You're going to be chanting for a really long time, but that's a prize chitta. That's something that will balance. You know? So there's rituals and prayers and tapas and things that we can do to balance, to neutralize the effects of our negative karmas. And it's interesting, you find this type of thing in other religions also. In the Catholic Church, they have confession, you know, where the priest can absolve you of those sins. We need to be absolved somehow from our sins, but we might think there's a God on high, but we're actually doing a karma and getting a karma phala, you know. So that doesn't demean God or the personal relationship you can have with Ishwara. It's just not he's a God in heaven looking down. So your whole relationship with Bhagawan becomes your relationship with everything, your whole relationship with the whole experienced world and with your body and mind and sense organs is all Ishwara, you know. And so there's Ishwara's ever-present internally and here. This is all Ishwara, and myself is Ishwara, the Atma. You know, and so it's a very different kind of way of looking at it. So it's not that he's a man in heaven who looks down knowing what's best for us, but the creation knows what's best for itself. And I'm a little piece of that creation. My prarabdha karma is the creation I get to enjoy as a jiva. And so that part, if you think all parts know what's best for the whole, then as you just start to be with the creation or be with Ishwara in that way, you just continue, I mean, personally speaking, you continue to be overwhelmed by the genius of it. You have to stop thinking of yourself as the center of the center. You are the center as Brahman, you know, not you are the center as this body, mind, sense organs. You're a cell. You're a cell in even the prarabdha karma. But what's the best for this, for the whole? How to balance that out. So that's really beautiful too, like having a just a continual type of noticing of that. Can free will jiva srishti mess up our prarabdha karma? It can make the prarabdha karma that could be benign and free of sorrow for a jnani as being full of strife because of the attitude, because of your attitude. And the attitude could be caused by the way you were brought up. Like, say, for instance, if you were brought up by abusive, violent people who were violent to others. I've known situations like this where a person themselves is highly violent, but then their family was highly violent and abusive to others, even outside of the family. Criminals. You know, not nice criminals. There's nice criminals too. They're good criminals. Nice people. I'm talking about really violent people, you know. And so you find yourself being a very violent person. That's how you were treated. That's how you were brought up. Those are the kind of the adharmic way of behaving in society. Just cheating everybody and knocking people up. Kind of like mafia type things. Even in the mafia, as I understand, the mafia guys, they hide it from their family. They want their, you know, children to all be good kids and all of that. So, you know, they don't even let their wife really know what's going on. Anyway, never mind. Associative thinking. So you can, I don't think you can't exactly change your prarabdha karma, but you can make it very unpleasant for yourself and others in that prarabdha karma. Because the prarabdha karma is kind of the flow of experiences that come your way. You have an awful lot of free will over how you respond to those experiences and how you respond to other people in your prarabdha karma. You have some free will, and there's a lot of growth that takes place around that too, you know. And the fact that you were born in such a criminal family is also your prarabdha karma. Because why were you born in that family and not in a family of jnanis? Well, maybe you had a rough patch in your last birth where you were acting like a criminal. I mean, who knows? It's very complex. But that was your birth this time around, and you attracted that from a Vedantic standpoint. You attracted that birth by who you were at that time of death. Those are the parents for you. Those are your, that is your family. And so you're not somebody who just, somebody, I've read a little article on it, people who felt like they were misplaced zygotes. The zygote is that, you know, in the fetus, as soon as it you know, that fertilization takes place in the womb, that little fetus is there, you know. And so this one ended up in that womb accidentally. I belong to that womb over there, not in this one. I'm a misplaced zygote. So anyway, sorry. I don't have much more to say on that. So for us, and so this question, can our free will, jiva srishti, mess up our prarabdha? Just, it can make it painful. Or only creates learning opportunities. But for us, our prarabdha does create lots of learning opportunities that are exactly what we need, you know. If it's the thing is, if the prarabdha decree is a learning opportunity for you, the reason it's a learning opportunity is because you need something to learn. There's something there to learn, and there's something there to learn because you're having some sort of a reaction, you know, to it. When that's been learned, then that event just goes by like, you know, the majority of all other events. It's just life. But it's not necessarily a learning opportunity for you because there's no rub there, you know. So you're just part of the flow and no problem. So that's why the problems are always our sadhana. It's not hard to recognize our sadhana. Just suffer a little bit of pain, that's all you need. That's it. It's like sadhana, sadhana. Yeah. Not hard. Can you expand more on there being no punya papa for a mumukshu who accepts everything with a prasada buddhi? If we accidentally lose our cool and yell at someone, I understand that the mumukshu can use it as an opportunity for inner growth, but what about the person or being who was on the wrong end of our act that would have created papam for an ajnani? Or that would have created papa for an ajnani. Even though we can accept the act with prasada buddhi, the other person cannot. Yeah. You need to learn how to apologize. Yeah. When you do something that's hurtful to another person, it's nice to be able to say, you know, I was really angry at you and you didn't really deserve my acting out like that on you. I'm really sorry. Because that's a nice thing to do, because why leave bad feelings there? Because you weren't able to handle your raga dvesha, basically. So it's a good thing to apologize when you feel that you've done hurt somebody. So when we say there's no punya or papa for a mumukshu who accepts everything with a prasada buddhi, okay. With the prasada buddhi, there's the I'm doing this given thing for a result. That's the reason that I'm doing it. So there's that kartritvam involved, and that I take the result as prasada. But there I'm actually doing a karma. When we're talking about the prasada buddhi, first of all, what the Vedas and the Vedanta is talking about, and then we translate that over into any action. But normally, for a Hindu, there are kamya karmas. There's different kind of karmas. One is called kamya karmas. Those karmas are things that I do in order to get a particular result. A mumukshu will give up those karmas. I don't even perform those rituals. I don't perform. I give up performing the kamya karmas. What we say now for our life, if you're doing a kamya karma in terms of an action, because you're driven to do that, and that's where you happen to be in your life, is I really want this, then we say, do it and accept the results with that prasada buddhi. Okay. But from a Hindu perspective, these kamya karmas, these rituals that are done for, in order to attract a given result, I give up those rituals. And I'm left with the nitya and naimittika and prayaschitta, right, type of rituals. The nitya karmas are ones that I do on a daily basis. Naimittika I do on an occasional basis. Prayaschitta karmas I do to kind of try to neutralize any papas that I'm afraid of having incurred. For jnani, I am doing the nitya naimittika karmas, you know, the daily and the occasional rituals. I do those daily as I'm supposed to do, as being, you know, either a brahmachari or being a grahastha, a householder, or in the vanaprastha, or in sannyasa it becomes different. I'm giving all karmas are given up by a ritual. But in these karmas, I'm not doing them so that I can get punya. Whereas a grahastha or a samsari is doing those rituals, as Bhagavan says, in order to gain Bhagavan's favor, you know, so Bhagavan will be pleased with me, you know, so that I can accrue punya, so that I can get a better next birth or go to heaven. A mumukshu is not doing those rituals for punya or papa, neither. Doing it only for antakarna shuddhi. That's why I do the ritual. And I do the rituals daily because it's my duty. It's enjoined on me as a Hindu. Okay? So those I do, and I accept. I do it for antakarna shuddhi, or I do it because that's what's expected of me by Bhagavan. That's what's expected of me. Not for punya. I don't care about punya. I'm not trying to get another next birth. You know, I don't want another next birth. I want self-knowledge. And so that's what that means there. So here, I would say for a Westerner, when you come to this knowledge, it depends on where you are at in terms, because we don't have these rituals that we're doing, right? So even for a Hindu, if they have strong desires, then you don't want to stop them from doing what is kind of their swadharma, or also we call their swabhava, their prakriti, what the jiva upadi, what the mix of sattva, rajas, and tamas of the prakriti is impelling you to do, you know. And that was Arjuna's issue also. He was a kshatriya. He had his swabhava, the prakriti, the material, the maya materials, the combination of sattva, rajas, and tamas, had gave him a certain disposition, you know, and certain desires. So let him fulfill those, let him work for those, accepting everything with that prasada buddhi. And then as his mind becomes more sattvic, or our minds become more sattvic, it's no longer about fulfilling raga dvesha, you know, fulfilling my desires. The raga dvesha actually drops off. And I just like to be here and do what's being asked of me, not for Puni and Papa. It's either I'm liberated, and so there I'm just here, I'm just doing what is asked of me to the best of my ability, or I'm doing what's asked of me for prasada buddhi so that I can get this knowledge, right? So that I can mature in this knowledge. And the Punya Papa aspect of it is not, it's really not in the picture, because that's already something that I've dismissed and I have no real value for. And if you do have a value for it, by the time you've been to several classes, that value will be destroyed by the teacher. Because all of this type of the effects of Ajnanam also are analyzed, and you know, and so there's something that you drop off. There's no reason to work for Punya or Papa when you're a Mumukshu. You're working to know yourself, know the Atma. Yeah. Antakaran Shuddhi, could you please develop that again? The Antakaran Shuddhi is really what we get from the prasada buddhi. It's basically a mind that is free of raga dvesha. That's, and to really be free of raga dvesha, you have to be free of ajnanam, self-ignorance. So the Antakaran Shuddhi requires the self-ignorance to be removed and the raga dvesha to be removed. And when that's the case, I have a pure mind. That pure mind means, for a mumukshu, it means that my mind has shanti, you know. Enough shanti to be able to gain this knowledge. And then that shanti, as you're gaining the knowledge and these and this, that karma yoga buddhi becomes more and more easy for you, the neutralization of the raga dveshas, my mind gains more and more subtlety in terms of its shanti. So the mind becomes almost indiscernible from just your own presence, you know, because it doesn't have any problems, you know. And that takes some time. But so that Antakarana Shuddhi for a mumukshu is very close to the Antakarana Shuddhi that a jnani has, you know, and it comes through removal of self-ignorance and that karma yoga buddhi, the neutralization of raga dvesha. Swamiji's little introduction to this part of chapter 2, near the end of chapter 2, and he's dealing with the raga dvesha, the karma yoga buddhi that we've actually just finished. What he says is that, he just says, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's all about the Antakarana Shuddhi, it's all about neutralization of raga dvesha. That's why I'm focusing a little bit on that now in the meditations, because if you look at what's bothering you, or yeah, basically pick anything, what's bothering you, and then trace it back and say, well, you know, what is it that I want and what is it that I'm not getting? You know, because that's the problem. You know, even if, say, in your family, or say in your community or in a group of friends or whatever, there's a, like an interloper. An interloper means somebody who's kind of joined in it and then is causing, because of their own psychological problems or things, you know, that they really are very, very difficult to handle, and they make things, they bring in a lot of stress into the community, and, you know, are always challenging you, and all of a sudden, instead of having your nice, warm little huggy group, you know, of close friends and people that you just love to be with, there's this person has joined who is a very, very hostile and very aggressive and all of that kind of stuff. And so then you can want to keep that person out, or wish that person wasn't there, wish they would just go away, you know. And then that's your situation then. You have a big raga dvesha. It's really a dvesha toward it's a kama. You have a big kama in reference to this person because of what you want. What you want is to have, you know, this happy, huggy community where everybody gets along together and they really love each other and you can just relax, you know. And also you as part of the member, you also want to be loved by everybody and to love everybody. That's what we want. Okay, so now somebody comes in that makes it very hard because they just have a disturbance. They have some sort of a disturbance. And so now, the thing is as you're trying to deal with this person, your mind is always trying to deal with this person even when they're not there. Your mind's always sort of circling around this person in this way, that way. So I hope you can recognize this situation. So if you can recognize this situation, then, as I was saying this morning, you know, when Swamiji says you have to take everybody fresh, this is a beautiful example of that, because what happens is this person who has kind of invaded your territory in a way, in a negative way, you know, comes, is doing their thing, whatever it is. You have to be there and deal with that. And then they go, or they're gone for a few days. Now your mind just, they're gone. Forget about it. They're gone. When they come back, whoever they are, deal with that. That's taking a person fresh. They go out, they're creating all kinds of havoc. They go out of the room, they're gone. When they come back, see who they are. Deal with them. I saw Swamiji do this for years. whoever is there. Because just look at yourself. Sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad, sometimes you're irritated, you're this and you're that. But if the person just deals with the one who's here right now, you know, and then when that one goes, they're gone. Come back, they're there. That is a beautiful discipline or skill. You could have that skill. It's just unconsciousness that stops us from having it, because we don't even realize that our mind is carrying this person around. This person is always around, even when they're not here. You know, taking up all this real estate in your mind. Just deal with them when they're here, you know. And then you have to look at, how do you deal with them when they're here? Because they're difficult. They have difficulties, you know. For everybody. So I'm using an example here. There's so many different variants that we could. But I'd say the person who really has some themselves, they have some difficulties. You know, they have some personality difficulties and whatnot. So how do you deal with them when they're here? Do you have that non-binding raga dvesha? You need the non-binding raga dvesha. I would rather that this wasn't here, but okay. And then how to be objective? You know, without that, with a non-binding raga dvesha, how to really be objective, how to be helpful in the situation. And that's just a wonderful learning, to learn how to be helpful in the situation rather than acting out of your dvesha, you know, because they're making a mess out of your life because they're such a big problem. That's raga dvesha. You don't want to go there. You want to use it as a sadhana, you know, so that you can be in any situation, you know, with non. It's just a beautiful thing, and you feel so good also. And you're able to be objective and helpful instead of mean, you know, mean and cruel. You feel so good. I've seen Swamiji do that so many times. Just being patient and helpful and trying to handle the situation without any personal vendetta, you know. So that's not always easy to do. You have to, if it is always easy, you have a lot of antakarana shuddhi. If that's always easy for you to do, for most of us, that's a real growth, being able to grow big enough to do that, you know. You're big enough to do that, so I'm just, you know, your heart's as big as Ishwara, because you can handle the people who are really, really hurt. Hard to handle for you. It might not be hard for somebody else, but sometimes the person is really a disturbed person. So they're pretty hard on everybody, but they're still belong to you. Still part of you, because they're here. It's enough. I'll do these two little tiny ones. I've got an airplane. This is an airplane, and this is a little teeny envelope. So nice. Yeah. So we'll do this tomorrow. Okay. Oh, that's it. One.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram,
Jai Jai Ram,
Jai Jai Ram,
Om.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram,
Jai Jai Ram,
Jai Jai Ram.
Shri Rama Jaya Rama
Jaya Jaya
Rama Om
Rama Om
Rama Om
Rama Om
Rama Om
Rama Om
Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivesasya Shalini Desho yam chobarahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.